This is The Human
and the Machine,
brought to you by Editorial Intelligence in association with Vodafone. Welcome, I'm Georgina Godwin, and on the show ahead, we'll be looking at AI and all besides in this brave new technological world.
The big questions of now are how we reap and harvest the full potential of an extraordinary flood of technologies from AI and sensors and blockchain and so on in ways which actually make our lives better.
And we'll be discussing
everything and anything that involves an algorithm of some type, which is self-propagating by a machine, is classed as AI. But it's very difficult to call it artificial intelligence.
For me, the humanity element is about the ability to apply wisdom, apply judgment, and that sense of innovation in imagination, which cannot be replicated by a machine.
Plus, Lord David Putnam kicks off the first of our regular features on the best and worst of tech.
The ability to release teachers and students from the sheer dreariness of education norms and allow the use of digital media to just make the whole process of learning, teaching and learning, more vivid, more exciting, more interesting and more relevant.
That's all ahead right here on The Human and the Machine. Stay with us.
Hello, I'm Julia Hobsbawm. And the theme we're really exploring today with our panel of techno-savvy humans is AI and machine learning. But I'm also in conversation with Jeff Mulgan, the big mind behind the new book, Big Mind, How Collective Intelligence Can Change the World.
Great. Well, what we want to do with The Human and the Machine is to bring you snippets of some of the most interesting ideas and conversations happening in the worlds of business, creativity, policymaking, around all the myriad implications of technology. We're a sort of guide, aren't we, Julia? It's a way to interpret how tech makes us tick.
Exactly.
So, that's coming up shortly. But now, here's the acclaimed film producer, Lord David Putnam. Now, David's won Oscars, I think 10 at the last count, BAFTAs, 25 of those, and a Palme d'Or for movies such as The Killing Fields, Midnight Express, The Mission, and Chariots of Fire. Well, he now focuses primarily on his work in public policy, in education, the environment, and the creative and communications industries. Now, importantly for us, he sits on the British House of Lords Select Committee on Artificial Intelligence, which considers the economic, ethical and social implications of advances in AI. Well, I caught up with him in Sri Lanka at the Fairway Gaul Literary Festival.
I'm a member of a 13-person select committee in the House of Lords, and what's so interesting is it's the House of Lords doing it, not the Commons, when you think about it. This is artificial intelligence, cutting-edge stuff. Commons hasn't got time for it, and we're doing it. We're preparing a report which is going to be published in March, basically on the nature of legislation that would be required to address the challenges of AI. That's a big, rather pompous political way of putting it. But the truth is, when you actually look at the opportunities of AI, and they're unquestioned, extraordinary opportunities, there are also moral and ethical issues that come in parallel with them. There's job loss issues, there's employment, enormous employment implications. How do you legislate to take account of the dangers as well as taking account of the opportunities? And if there's any kind of clash on that committee, it will be between those who believe that the opportunities outweigh the dangers and those who are concerned that the dangers may well end up outweighing the opportunities.
This is The Human and the Machine, with me, Georgina Godwin and Julia Hobsbawm. Well, let's now turn to our panel discussion to continue today's theme of AI. Julia, over to you.
So we're going to talk about an idea every episode of The Human and the Machine, and it stands to reason that the big idea to start with is AI. I'm joined by three experts who come variously from the corporate world, the think tank world, the cyber world of retail, and they're going to introduce themselves. Let's have the voice of the corporation first. Tracy, who are you and what do you do?
My name is Tracy Groves and I lead Intelligent Ethics Limited. The focus of my work is to help organisations understand what is the right thing to do to operate in line with their purpose, with their strategy, but most importantly, with their values.
And I'm also joined in the studio by one of the leading think tanks, experts on the whole digital world, Carl Miller. Carl.
Hi there. I'm the research director at the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at Demos. And over the last year, I've been writing a book on the changing nature of power in the digital age.
Finally, Tom Adeyula, you run a very interesting business called Metail. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's right. I'm the CEO and founder of Metail. We're currently using everything from computer vision, machine learning, deep learning, everything you can catch under the term of AI effectively to make clothing fit for all. And how we're going about that in the fashion world is by digitizing garments for everybody to be able to try on their virtual self to see how it fits.
Do you think we know what AI is? I feel that terms like AI and the fourth industrial revolution are bandied about. I mean, no. Just give me an idiot's guide here. What is AI, Tom?
I think nobody does, really. I think we go through these cycles of wanting to use big terms to talk about things we don't understand. It's not that long ago that the big term was big data. I remember somebody saying at the time, it's sort of like teenage sex, where everybody's talking about it, but nobody's actually doing it. And I think we've come through that now to AI as well. So everything and anything that involves an algorithm of some type, which is self-propagating by a machine, is classed as AI. But it's very difficult to call it artificial intelligence. I think for me, artificial intelligence means something much, much bigger. It means something which is basically determining and deciding upon things on and of its own. When I think about AI and artificial intelligence, I think about sci-fi films. I don't think about what's actually happening in today's world. But I think the thing which is really interesting about today's world, and which is why we've started to talk about it in these grandiose terms, is because I think the previous era was about collecting the data. Big data was about how can you get the data and then do something with it. We've solved that problem of how can you get data at scale and how can you share it over the cloud with all of your different entities. The current era now is we have computing power at such an insane speed that we're able to churn through that data and come up with insights and ways of coming up with different strategies from a business and an organizational perspective that we couldn't have thought of by ourselves.
And so what is the next big thing, given that the speed and scale of effectively computing capacity, I mean, 50 plus years after Moore's law first predicted that computer capacity would effectively double every 2 years, I think that limit has sort of run out because things have become so accelerated and so nano. So you're saying that, you know, big data has effectively been solved. We know how to amass and process the data. So what is the next frontier?
So I think the frontier is how to basically come up with insights through that data and in real time in ways in which humans can't do physically. So I think therefore it's the automation piece that's missing. The automation now and the ability to automate real hard challenges is incredible.
So Tracy, corporations, and you had a 25-year plus career with PwC. I mean, service industries are sort of licking their lips at this moment, aren't they? Thinking that they're going to lead companies through the thicket. But what can they give businesses about this new frontier that Tom is describing? What do they know about AI?
It's a great question, Julia, because for me, through all my years of experience in the business world, it's about education and responsibility. And for me, the greatest opportunity, as well as my greatest fear, is about organisations being able to understand the consequences of what the automation is going to be able to deliver. So thinking about those consequences in terms of the impact on our workforce, the impact on human relationships and the level of trust or lack of trust, shall we say, between individuals and within organisations. But most importantly, being able to think through not only how is this in line with my strategy and my corporate purpose, but what are the societal outcomes that are going to be produced as a result of the deployment of the AI? That's my biggest opportunity that I would like to see happening.
Ethics are very hard to police in the best of times, aren't they? But in a sort of fairly unregulated world, they're going to be even harder to name and to navigate and to have a framework for. I mean, do you feel there needs to be a new frontier in ethics along with the new digital frontier?
I feel there needs to be greater accountability for the application of ethical principles within this new framework. So being able to understand when we talk about transparency and openness in the design of algorithms and those programs, what does that actually mean? And how much do we need as a society to understand how these decisions are being made? So putting a set of rules and controls and legislation, I don't think will work on by themselves.
Carl, we're recording this at a moment when there is a tremendous tech backlash, when the digital giants of the last 15 years, the Facebooks, the Googles, are sort of hated in some quarters. Is that what you're seeing, that there is a sort of ethical regulatory debate going on, or is the heat and the energy also around technology?
I mean, we've seen the rise of five companies who represent the most extraordinary concentrations of both informational power and excellence, world-beating excellence in AI, that we've ever seen. This is not an equal or evenly distributed revolution whatsoever. This is an area where a very small number of concentrations of very, very smart people, mind-boggling amounts of data, and essentially almost infinite amounts of money is really driving it forwards. And of course, I mean, I think part of the backlash here is that everyone can feel the world changing around them. Everyone can feel that AI is either going to pervade or is already pervading into their industry. And they feel like this is being something being done to them, not something that they are actually part of. I think that very much explains, actually, in a kind of ironic way, a massive sense of powerlessness that people have over a revolution which is, you know, in a kind of broader way, giving people so many more insights and so much more information and control over the world than ever before.
Isn't it the case, though, that on the one hand, we can say there are obvious similarities with the first industrial revolution, that we are in the white heat of the moment when the kind of infrastructure networks were first built and industrialised and connected society. And yet and but, we're in a completely new era because the cognitive capabilities of algorithms and computing could, in fact, outsource the human far greater than anything the factories witnessed. Tom, you're in one of the most disrupted industries around, which is fashion and retail. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's a really interesting time right now. I think over the previous 10 years, everybody has always in that industry talked about innovation and using technology, but it's a real tipping point moment right now for many different reasons. So there's one, obviously, technology happening in the background, but you've got a big geopolitical change which is forcing things. So you've got the end of cheap labor, with China increasing minimum wages and pushing factories out. So people have been trying Vietnam and Thailand, and that was based on TPP. And then Trump's come into power and he's kicked that into the long grass.
So just say again what TPP is for anyone who doesn't know.
Trans-Pacific Partnership. So It was a big free trade area. And as a consequence, you've got this pull back to national countries and national-based production. So for these big manufacturing guys, they're saying, well, hold on a minute. Like, we can't produce any cheaper with labor. So they're getting this sense of a forced push towards robots, automation, data. And there are all the other trends happening at the same time. So consumers want things faster. They want things higher quality. So how is that going to be delivered? So this is a moment where suddenly all of these big old school manufacturers where everybody used to sew things by hand are now moving towards how can I do this better? You know, one of the big clothing manufacturers we work with, they hadn't until now been able to find a computer algorithm that could tessellate patterns onto fabric better than a human trained person. Whereas that now, that is pretty easy to do, like with machine learning.
But the human is still integrated within that service. So the person who delivers your Amazon parcel is a critical part of that interface. And I think you were telling me that Amazon now has technology that can track the movements of its workers. And there's a lot of heat about how human workers in increasingly industrialized environments are being denied their humanness. So there are tensions there, aren't they? Because the speed and the scale at which digital services can deliver are in conflict often with the human side.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've always felt probably previously that the robots and AI would take over low-grade jobs. and do things like delivery, you know, automated robots bringing stuff to your home, etc. But actually what we're seeing is that automation and AI can start to do the more creative jobs as well. You know, we're working with an Indian company who have a whole brand that is machine learning built, designed, and it's based off understanding what people are buying live in real time and then creating whole new designs based on that. And Amazon is sort of doing the same thing. So the creative process is now turned into a machine learning based one.
I think I am still in that sort of Luddite generation where, you know, I'm 53 years old and I used to watch films like The Stepford Wives, where, which was a sort of feminist dystopia where the women's brains were reprogrammed by men. And there's this absolutely amazing, terrible scene at the end with Catherine Ross in a supermarket aisle malfunctioning. I mean, Tracy, do I need to trust the machine, the robot, to be creative and to get it right? Or am I right that I really worry about whether the machine can ever do it all in the way that we think it can?
Well, Julie, if I can join you in the Luddite camp, I think, in terms of my concern about putting machines in a place where they can be creative, because for me, the humanity element is about the ability to apply wisdom, apply judgment, and that sense of innovation in imagination, which cannot be replicated by a machine. And the concern I have, which is about the impact of us thinking about removing the human element of that. I'm not saying that machines can't do a huge amount of automation, very efficient, very effective routine processing work. What I am fearful of is that we're not thinking about the ability for that human judgment to be called into play at times of critical moments. I'll give you an example, if I may. For example, the impact on AI and the healthcare system in particular, given the aging population, the demographics, and we know that we are going to have to get much more efficient and think about how we are caring for our older population. And in Asia, for example, the use of machines to support people in their old age is becoming more and more prevalent. However, they still don't know when to give their elderly patient a cup of tea.
Yeah.
They still don't know when actually somebody needs to have their hand held. And that's the bit that I'm saying, let's just be wary and ask these questions before it's too late, because these fantastic algorithms are happening and being used right now.
A quick question, though. On that, do you think that those jobs will become more valued? I'm wondering whether the human side will become more valued. So almost like we could see a renaissance of those types of jobs being properly valued by society.
Well, the authors of The Second Machine Age, that very seminal book that came out in 2015, which pretty much put into public debate this question about the comprehensive outsourcing of the human. They wrote a less noticed article in Foreign Affairs magazine that year, which said exactly this point, that ultimately the service industries where you want face-to-face interaction and you want to be given contact by another human, they are going to flourish. The question is what that premium will be and whether everything else will be sort of downgraded. Carl, I wanted to move on as we round up this discussion. Your focus is very much about social media. Social media seems to me the most accessible tip of the algorithm-led revolution. And yet that also feels like it's kind of going wonky and a bit wrong.
Yeah, I mean, social media was one of the first sources of the data which AI began to be built on this time around. And most of the companies that have now become quite generalist leaders in AI began as social media or advertising companies. There's a point that I've been wanting to make, which is that I think the kind of fundamental problem is this. Like, there is inevitable huge economic forces which are sweeping AI more and more widely into life. And there's nothing we can do about that. Previous industrial revolutions have similarly created vast concentrations of power as a result of economic forces. And what we're doing at the moment is we're kind of groping back to the ways in which we controlled power in the past. So last time around, we created all this bag of principles, things like accountability, openness, transparency, which we kind of wrapped that power in order to make it more civilized, more human in many ways. And it is unbelievably difficult to know how we can apply those principles to algorithms today. Mm. I mean, saying we should make algorithms transparent
I don't think we should actually let that go. I think we should challenge ourselves to say, how transparent can we make it? It doesn't necessarily have to be entirely so.
Well, we
should be asking the question about what is the correct and appropriate level of openness so that people understand, I applied for this mortgage application and I haven't got it. Why not?
That's my livelihood, my home.
I
think we need new ideas for how we control this power. And I don't think transparency is going to be the way in which we do it. So one of the things I've been doing for my book is spending some time in Silicon Valley with tech workers from these huge companies. Now, I can't say which company this tech worker was from, but after quite a lot of persuading, he finally showed me the algorithm, one of the algorithms which actually kind of we use every day. It wasn't easy to do, and he took quite a significant professional risk in showing it to me. But there on the screen was this algorithm. And he kind of tried to show me how it worked. And it was layer after layer after layer after layer of abstraction. This isn't one algorithm. Mm. This is hundreds of different algorithms. Yeah. And each algorithmic team is working on one little bit of it. It's like an assembly line. You know, it's like that one team is putting the wheels on, one team is tuning the engine, one team is applying a paint job. The algorithm is being fed by outputs from other algorithms, and it alone is feeding into other algorithms. And all of that is happening dynamically.
And the problem therein lies, well...
How do you make that transparent?
Yeah, you go
to the next... How on earth can human beings understand that?
Especially when you get to generative adversarial networks, which is the next big layer, which is an algorithm fighting another algorithm to work out different strategies. So they're actually left on their own, which was the whole new thing with AlphaGo. So then you don't know how it's made its decision.
Yeah,
so you don't know how something went wrong. You have to go back in time. So that's very different accountability to our current way where... If something goes wrong, you can go back through all the decisions made. Whereas this is, you don't know how it made its decision.
I would like to close with the following point about transparency, which is Facebook ran into such huge ethical difficulty because it made decisions, and indeed Google, about the use of its algorithms that made what it was doing untransparent at just a consumer level. You suddenly didn't know when you searched for something on Google what would come up because they'd switched it not to have a linear record of search, but a promotional-based level of search. And so I don't think we should give up on transparency completely. I agree with you that it can't be the obvious metric because it's so opaque in its design. That seems to be what you're saying, Carl. But the politics of transparency and needing to know what you're getting, we're agreed we need that or not. Final word to you, each of you. Carl, do we not need transparency anymore, or you're just saying it's not the only measurement?
I think an algorithm can be made transparent at general level by a company explaining what it's being trained to overall try and do. So
Right. You
can say a Facebook news algorithm is basically trying to learn what you find interesting, to identify things which are similar to that and then feed them to you. I think anything which is trying to actually open that algorithm up in any kind of technological or code-based way is completely impossible. It's not going to expose in any meaningful way how that algorithm works. People aren't going to be able to see and understand it.
But I'm good with that, aren't you, Tracy? I don't want to look inside my television set.
Absolutely not. It wouldn't interest me, nor would I understand it. What I would need to understand in order for me to trust my television set is that there is a level of understanding and it's communicated to me in a way that is relevant, that it uses a language that I understand, and that I can rely on it to give me a consistent and accurate outcome.
Tom, for you, doesn't transparency hinge on something else entirely, which is availability and accessibility? Your consumers, your customers, they want a transparency of transaction.
Yeah, I think so. But I think the difficulty with transparency around algorithms or the AI side is that it ends up being very 1-0 rather than grey. So, you know, take the trolley dilemma. You know, if the car's going down, it's got a choice between killing one person versus five. In the human scenario, you're like, well, the human's going to do everything he can do to minimise loss of life, and, you know, he tried his best, etc. The computer version is always going to kill the one person, right? So that person's always going to die. And having that sense of, I know that that person's always going to die, that's quite a difficult thing to think about ethically and as a human race. And I think that's something we're going to have to try and figure out, because that's a difficult concept.
Well, this was the first panel discussion of The Human and the Machine, and you've all set the bar very high. Thank you very much to Carl Miller, to Tracy Groves, and to Tom Adeyula.
This is The Human
and the Machine,
brought to you by Editorial Intelligence in association with Vodafone.
So, Georgina, you're my technological partner in crime on this podcast, and the regular feature we've devised is the one in which our guests talk about the technology we love, techno heaven, the technology we hate, techno hell, but also how we tune out from technology, what I call techno Shabbat. So how about you?
You know, my techno hell and heaven is almost the same, and it kind of brings in techno Shabbat too, which is this. I think that we should have inbuilt into meals out or any kind of social engagement, you should be allowed a phone break, because I find 20 minutes without looking at my phone and I'm getting twitchy because there are so many things that need replying to instantly. But obviously it's enormously rude if you're going out to supper with somebody and you're looking at your phone, and I think they should absolutely be put away. But I think we've got to the point in our lives where you have to say, that's fine, 20 minutes in, we're all allowed 5 minutes just to catch up with what we need to do, and then you're back in the room.
I mean, you've got a point. There's certainly nothing more irritating and rude. A bit like being in a party where people's eyes slide over you, behind you, to the person they think is more interesting than you. There's nothing worse than being in a meal or even in a meeting when people are, in fact, eyes down. However, I think learning to switch off is important and requires a different mindset, which is, I am going to do this, and you need a bit of build up. Going cold turkey and just saying, right, that's it, you know, I'm disconnecting, is very, very hard for people. But can I just give you one little bit of techno heaven for me? I drive all over the city of London. I do also walk, but I drive. My idea of heaven is a functional parking app, and it twins to my idea of techno hell, which is when those apps don't work, I'm really, really skewered.
Absolutely. You know, I can totally see that. And that kind of our dependence on technology is so frightening. I mean, I have this vision of an apocalypse, which is that the net will crash and nobody will be able to contact anybody else ever again. We don't know where anyone lives anymore. We just know their email addresses or their, and we don't know their phone numbers. I can see how the end of the world might be coming.
Well, there's two words to instill a chill in our hearts, and those two words are solar flare. That could happen, Georgina. Let's hope it doesn't happen while we're still on air.
This is the Human and the Machine. Technology has good and bad elements for all of us. We're going to return now to David Putnam briefly, who gives us his
techno heaven.
The ability to release teachers and students from the sheer dreariness of education norms and allow the use of digital media to just make education, the whole process of education, the whole process of learning, teaching and learning, more vivid, more exciting, more interesting and more relevant. And I think that the digital world can contribute massively to that. I've been an advocate of this for a long time. We haven't got it right yet, there's no question. But I do think that the next generation of teachers are going to need every scrap of help they can get, and there's no question that the digital world does have the capacity to offer that help and enhance the teaching and learning process.
Techno heaven.
If you like the ideas here and want to know more, you can visit thehumanandmachine.com, which also has details of our forthcoming pop-up city symposiums on the subject. For instance, we'll be in Berlin in May and Milan in September. And you can also find the programmes from previous pop-ups. Maybe join us there.
This is the Human
and the Machine.
And it's time now for our one-on-one interview. I'm going to hand you back to Julia to introduce this week's featured guest.
Well, I'm joined now by Jeff Mulgan. He's always been known as the Big Brain, and he's written a book called Big Mind: How Collective Intelligence Can Change Our World. He is the head of NESTA, the UK's National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts, and the co-chair of the World Economic Forum's Global Future Council on Innovation and Entrepreneurship. And Jeff, I've known you for a long time, and you have been an early proponent of discussing the meaning of technology on our lives. Is that a fair assessment of what actually drives your own thinking on this whole question of the human and the machine?
Well, I've been fascinated by digital technologies for several decades, and also always slightly frustrated that we aren't getting the full potential out of them, or that we go down slightly narrow cul-de-sacs, or that we have technologies, which I think is the theme of your concerns, which actually diminish our humanity rather than enhance it. And for me, really, the big questions of now are how we reap and harvest the full potential of an extraordinary flood of technologies from AI and sensors and blockchain and so on in ways which actually make our lives better.
I mean, in some ways, I regard us as having a similar sense of pessimistic optimism. You are quite optimistic in your book. You lay out some examples of what success looks like. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, my main interest in the book is in how we combine the best of artificial machine intelligence with collective and human intelligence. And I think in many of the things we will be proudest of in 10 or 20 years' time are where we find new ways to use technology to understand what's happening in the world, to gather data, observe, etc., to make sense of patterns, to predict, to help us create, but where we link those together with our human system. So in healthcare, for example, where we have amazing things analysing blood flow or biopsies and so on, but also working very closely, not just with doctors and nurses, but also with patients and people taking control of their own lives, using these to enhance themselves. That's the promise of Big Mind. And my premise is that almost any institution, from a parliament or a charity or a business, has the possibility of tapping into far richer resources of intelligence, some of which come from the technology, the hardware, the machines, but many of them come from people, their own staff, their customers, the wider community. And at the moment, very few are really realizing that potential at all.
Do you think that's partly because we've been so in love with what I call silico-evangelism, the narrative coming out of the tech companies for 25 years, that there's a machine for that, an app for that, that in some ways humans have become a bit lazy and flabby about using their collective intelligence, and they're beginning belatedly to realise that they can exercise it like an unused muscle?
Yeah, I think we still often have very polarized debates. The techno enthusiasts from Silicon Valley say technology will solve any problem. They oversell, they overhype. And then there's a sort of mirror response from the skeptics who say it's all rubbish, it's all completely useless. And we're therefore lacking really what is often quite a practical task of weaving the two together. So one example is democracy. I mean, I'm really excited by how, at the level of a city or a country, you can tap the intelligence of citizens to help solve problems. There are many examples of this from cities like Madrid and Barcelona to Helsinki or Taiwan, where democracy is being reinvented, not as
Estonia.
Or Estonia, yeah. Involving the public, who often have huge expertise on the issues being talked about, can generate ideas, comment, discuss. And all of that can be enhanced by digital tools. Even AI can help you sort of map the patterns of opinions. And out of that, you get a much more intelligent system. But in a way, our problem was the techno-enthusiasts sort of thought that automatically technology would solve these problems. We just have like or not like in a kind of Facebook way, which is definitely not a good way to transform democracy. And against them were the skeptics who just thought anything touched by data, AI, etc., was likely to be evil and predatory.
But isn't it also the case that we have, back to my sort of gripe that there is a sort of philosophical outsourcing of thinking and behaving done by humans, especially within government? I mean, you take the failure of governments to service citizens, certainly in the UK, on things like disability benefits, where you had at the time a government that absolutely venerated and celebrated the technology companies. You could walk into an Apple store and somebody with a handheld device would let you buy £1,000 worth of equipment in 5 minutes. And yet they actually could not use their data to determine who was actually disabled or not. And thousands of people suffered. So government, it seems to me, just didn't actually design systems properly, because they thought big data was going to do it for them.
Yeah, well, I think we've had a huge sort of distortion in the global brain here, which goes back many, many years. Most of the investment in the technologies we're talking about here, the technologies of the fourth industrial revolution, were dominated by the military. At least half the public spending on R&D in the US or the UK, let alone China, Russia, France, was dominated by how to kill people better or how to spy on them better. And then within business, the dominant investments have been things like YouTube recommendation engines. And the needs of something like disability is way, way down the list. Tiny, tiny investment of human brain power or technology. We're just starting quite an interesting project with Toyota for the Tokyo Olympics on how to mobilize creative solutions using AI to improve wheelchairs, mobility for the disabled. That's a great project, still quite small scale, but this is coming, say, way down the line and is tiny compared to the investment, either in quite trivial things in social media or quite damaging in the military. And I think one of the things we need is a movement to sort of shift that allocation of resources, that global brain, to the things which matter, real needs, because we've got amazing capacity worldwide to solve problems. But at the moment, I think it was Jeff Hammerbacker, the data scientist of Facebook, said the best minds of my generation are all focused on click-throughs on ads, not on solving things that matter.
I agree completely. As you know, my area is what I call social health, which is how we devise functional management of our connected lives. Toyota is an interesting case in point because, of course, they created lean management and that production line process soup to nuts approach, which in fact I know at least one healthcare business in the United States practices. And I wonder whether your concept of intelligent design is based along almost human-centered manufacturing processes. You do A and then you do B and then you do C in order to solve a problem. Seems to me that car manufacturers got it right a long time ago.
Well, Toyota was used quite a lot in the design of hospitals and the flow of people through hospitals. But I think where we are in healthcare now has to almost go a stage beyond that. If you think of the millions of people with multiple sclerosis or diabetes or a heart condition, what they need is in some ways a much more sophisticated set of sort of data inputs to monitor their own condition, access to the best available knowledge, access to the insights of other patients with conditions like theirs. And that's where I see a bit of a gap. And I've called it the gap of intelligence design. I think we're missing a profession, a skill set of how to weave together the data sources, the analytical sources, the predictive algorithms with human experience, with psychology, with culture, with meaning. And in healthcare, that's probably where the biggest gains will come in the next 10 or 20 years if we can move beyond the sort of lean manufacturing approach to throughputs of hospitals to systems where patients really are empowered to manage their own health with others and, say, tapping into the best available global knowledge about what works and what doesn't.
We'll have to fight it out for who wins out in the war of the phrase, you know, social health or intelligent design. But I am with you completely. And I do think that the vanguard is healthcare, precisely because the technological advances are undeniable. No human being on the planet wants to be without the availability of the latest diabetes sensor or robotic arm for surgery. And yet, unless that's married with patient experience and a sort of intuitive, highly reactive, person-focused treatment, everything is lost. And I wonder whether there is enough data gathering about who's doing what. A friend of mine has set up something called Our Brain Bank in the United States, an app that is designed for people with compromised cognitive abilities to function easily and share their experiences so that somebody with brain cancer in one part of the world can benefit from the experience of someone in another. And I want to ask you, related to this, are we doing enough politically to address this deficit, or are we still being driven by what's going to make the bucks?
Well, I think in healthcare, there's a big gap between what should be happening and what actually is happening. There are fascinating experiments underway on brain science is a really good example. That the US has a movement with 500,000 members linked through a website on sharing brain illness remedies and experiences. In the book, I look at examples around medical epidemics, for example, where there's a fantastic new sort of startup which is linking observation of new epidemics and things like Ebola and dengue fever with predictive algorithms to interpret how they might spread, linked then into public health workers to help them respond very quickly to stopping those epidemics. In fields like diabetes and dementia, there are sort of new projects tapping the insights of thousands of patients, so they do research on themselves in real time. But in terms of health debates in a country like the UK, they're still very old-fashioned. They're about funding hospitals.
Yeah.
To my mind, intelligence design, the mobilisation of knowledge, not just from medical science, but from people themselves, will be the heart of the NHS in 10, 20, 30 years' time. There's no doubt about it. But at the moment, they don't have really, the skills, the profession, the ways of weaving together the insights coming from, say, sensors within the blood and everything else, and ownership of patients. Cancer is a really good example. The English Cancer Registry, again, I talk about it in the book, is possibly the world's most sophisticated combiner of hundreds, if not thousands, of data sets on diagnoses, biopsies, patient records, and so on. It's linked to predictive algorithms, which will tell patients how long they might live with different treatments, linked to socioeconomic data, which will tell you if a family is at risk of going into debt because of the cancer, linked to genomics analysis from Genomics England. An extraordinary combination of data sources, but probably not yet very sophisticated about how that fits in with the real lived experience of someone with cancer, or their family, or the nurses, or the community health workers. And yet that's the promise. That shows us a picture of a future, a big mind-based health service, which I think will be dramatically superior to what we have now. And its core will be knowledge, not the physical infrastructure of hospitals.
Let's go back to our optimistic pessimism, though. My concern is that the structure and design of politics and policy making is inadequate for the task at hand. The excitement and the innovation is coming from architects, from planners, from designers, from people wanting to remake society around the technology. We're actually in a rather interesting architectural hub in London's King's Cross, where this studio is, which is looking at the way professional communities live with local communities, where innovation flourishes. You worked at 10 Downing Street for a long time. You're at heart a policy maker. Do you think that the next 10 years is going to see the humans keeping up with the machines?
I think there's a huge gap between what politics and government is doing and what's happening to technology. And we've been advocating new institutions to bridge that gap. And let me just give two or three live examples. So a few years ago, we proposed how you would create a machine intelligence commission to navigate all the issues around AI, bias in AI, problems of data sets, what should be transparent. To its credit, the British government a couple of months ago announced there would be a new Centre for Data Ethics and Innovation, a government regulatory body. They don't quite know, they haven't said what it will do, but it's an attempt to create a new institution to bring in issues of ethics and science and politics and policy to this crucial issue. More broadly, on regulation, we've been arguing for what we call anticipatory regulation, new methods for governments to work with very fast-changing technologies, autonomous vehicles, drones, AI in health again, and have been showing how around the world governments are using new methods like experimental sandboxes, test beds, zones and so on, so they can cope with the pace of change.
What is an experimental sandbox? Could you just explain?
So these were pioneered by in the financial fintech field, including by the FCA here in the UK, where there's an emergent sort of new technology, or it could be peer-to-peer lending or new forms of banking. They allow the entrepreneurs and innovators to work in a semi-simulated space with the regulators to flush out what the issues will be, what will work and what won't work. And that's worked very well. It's helped the UK get a fantastic sort of dynamism in its fintech industries. Two live examples. We were working on now. One is on banking, where the Competition and Markets Authority required the banks to open up their small business data so the small businesses could then lend it to a third party using new tools like AI to help them manage their services. They funded a program which Nesta is running, which 200 fintech entrepreneurs applied for to develop new products and services to make use of that data. Now, this is a completely new model of regulation. It uses open data, open innovation to enhance competition and the pace of innovation and making these technologies useful for the little guys, the small businesses, rather than just the big businesses. And we're hoping to extend that to energy and several other sectors this year. Drones is another example. We're running a program now with national government, the regulators, the drones industry and cities to work through all the use cases of drones, which may be, yeah, good for citizens. Some, again, in healthcare, some in policing, some in deliveries. But it's trying to create a whole system to think through the practical issues of making drones work for society rather than them just being imposed on us by, you know, Amazon or the military. And in all of these, we think there's an entirely new really toolkit for governments in this anticipatory regulation space, which will, I think, emerge very, very quickly. And indeed, just last week, we were holding events with the governments of India and Russia and UAE and Chile and others who are recognizing that their current structures of departments and agencies and regulators are wholly unsuited,
the silo,
to where technology is going. And partly because of the pace of change.
Yeah.
You don't know where they'll be in a year or two. So you can't just pass a law and then implement the law. It has to be much more iterative, much more agile, much more fast-changing and much more transparent in how it works.
And yet, I think we're agreeing, are we not, that whatever is coming down the track in terms of technological capability that is new, it's only going to be delivered by a marriage, a collaboration, an innovation with the old, i.e. us, the human.
Well, I think that's partly an ethical statement you just made, which I would certainly agree. But I think it's also pragmatic. So one of the reasons why the smart technology companies recognise that the sorts of things I described are probably good for them, new kinds of regulation, new kinds of public engagement, is that if they don't do that, they will repeat the mistakes made by the GM crops or nuclear power or many other industries which thought the technology was the solution on its own, didn't bring the public with them, didn't argue through openly what was the benefits, what were the costs, and then saw a public backlash which then blocked the technology development. It's very easy to see that happening with AI and data and all these other technologies, which the public could quite easily see as essentially a threat to their life, the things they hold dear, rather than an enabler. And that's why the smart industries are willing to engage with ethics, are willing to engage with the human, and are willing to open up a much wider conversation, not just of investors and techies, but of the general public, to make sure we reap, we harvest the best of their fruits.
Jeff Mulgan, the author of Big Mind, How Collective Intelligence Can Change Our World, published by Princeton University Press. Whether you buy it online or buy it manually in a bookshop, it's worth a read. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Human
and the Machine,
brought to you by Editorial Intelligence, in association with Vodafone. Now, Julia is well known for taking and promoting Techno Shabbat. Remind us of the concept, Julia.
Techno Shabbat is also known as digital detox, but I call it Techno Shabbat because on a Friday night, when customarily religious Jews, I'm an irreligious secular Jew, but Shabbat is when you wind down, go off technology and start to connect with your family. And so I followed actually a technology writer and filmmaker called Tiffany Schlain in the US who first coined the phrase Techno Shabbat. And I thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to have a Techno Shabbat. And I get asked about it all the time. So everyone's got their own version of Techno Shabbat, as we're going to find out. Every guest who comes into our studio is asked this question. How do they switch off, power down?
And we're going to return to Lord David Putnam to hear about his version.
And now for Techno Shabbat.
How do we detox? I get asked it every day by my wife. I think just trying to make sure that you use the digital environment in a responsible way. Here's the problem. My limited, and they are quite limited, digital capacity, does allow me to do a lot more than I could otherwise do. So, for example, putting together today's presentation at the Dol Literary Festival was fun. I mean, I'm able to edit, cut, use, steal, get onto YouTube, and turn what could be deemed to be pretty dull, difficult, complex subject into something that's got some vigour in it. So, I mean, for example, the applause today when I used the clip from Newsroom, that clip tells you more about the impacts of social media and the dangers of social media than anything I could say in half an hour wittering on. So the capacity of the digital world to give you those tools and to allow you to get that sort of messaging out in a way that young people certainly respond to, that's worth quite a lot of pain.
And that's it for this edition of The Human and the Machine. If you'd like to know more about the podcast, head to www.thehumanandmachine.com. Join us next time when we'll be talking to Hannah Such of app Go Jauntly and Charles Arthur, leading tech journalist. Many thanks to our guest Jeff Mulgan, to our panellists Tom Adeola, Carl Miller and Tracy Groves, and also to Lord David Putnam. This show is brought to you by Editorial Intelligence and it's sponsored by Vodafone. It's recorded at Spiritland in London's King's Cross. The Human and the Machine is researched by Alice Fielden. The executive producer is Julia Hobsbawm. And I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.